Hello, listeners, and welcome to this new episode of the Ballot Brief by Your Opinion, a podcast where we explain and analyze the various dynamics of the different elections taking place throughout the world in 2024. My name is Adeli, and I am your host for this podcast. This episode will be entirely dedicated to the European elections of 2024. This year, the EP elections are set to take place between the 6th and 9th of June 2024. This is the 10th time that the European Parliament elections will take place across the continent. If you are eligible to vote in your country, I strongly encourage you to inform yourself on the voting procedure and the different lists and candidate relative to your home state. The European Community, founded in 1957, became the European Union in 1992 with the signing and ratification of the Maastricht Treaty. As of 2019, the EU is composed of 27 member states and 448 million EU citizens. The European Union is composed of three major institutions: the Commission, the European Parliament, hereby EP, and the European Council. In this case, the European Parliament is the directly elected legislative body of the EU, where millions of EU citizens practice their democratic right to vote every 5 years. In the upcoming June elections, the EP will see its number of seats increase from 705 to 720. The European Parliament plays a crucial role in shaping EU legislation, such as approving the EU budget and holding other EU institutions accountable. The outcome of the European elections can have significant implications for the directions of EU policies and priorities. The EP hosts the members of the EP, hereby MEPs, from the 27 member states of the EU. Each member state is allocated a certain number of seats proportional to the population of the given member state. So, for instance, Germany has the highest number of seats, 96, because it has the largest population of the EU. France follows and sees an increase of 2 seats to reach 81 seats in the upcoming elections. The minimum number of seats for any member state is 6, for example with Luxembourg, Malta, and Cyprus. Other countries who seek an increase in the number of seats this year are Spain, Poland, the Netherlands, Belgium, amongst others. The voting system of the EP varies across member states to accommodate national, constitutional, political, legal, and institutional differences. Whilst most countries employ party-list proportional representation, where seats are allocated based on the proportion of votes received, some opt for mixed-member proportional representation or single transferable vote. Single transferable vote, used in countries like Ireland and Malta, allows voters to rank candidates in order of preference, ensuring proportional representation through a quota system. Mixed-member proportional representation integrates both proportional representation and single-member districts, allowing voters to cast 2 votes, one for a party list and one for a local candidate. Once candidates have been elected as representatives of their country, they go to the European Parliament and their list decides which European party to join. The EP is composed of 8 different political groups, with the 2 biggest ones being the European People's Party, the EPP, which is more center-right, and Progressive Alliance of Socialists and Democrats, hereby SND, which is center-left. Other parties include Renew Europe, European Conservatives and Reformists, and the Greens, amongst others. From there on, the MEPs vote on the EP president, who has a term of 2.5 years. The EP further contributes to the Spitzenkandidaten procedure, which designates the president of the Commission. This is done by voting in favor of a candidate put forward by the European Council. Throughout every episode of this podcast so far, including this one, I have mentioned poll estimates of voting. However, I believe that the mechanisms of surveys and polling for elections are often blurry on the minds of citizens, and hence should be clarified. For this, the Ballot Brief is happy to welcome its first guest, Jean-Philippe Dubrulle, political scientist and director at IFOP, a French survey institute.
Hello. Thank you for having me today.
You have been working in the world of surveys, more specifically political surveys, for quite some time now. Can you explain to our listeners the purpose of a survey and how it is used to explain behaviors in France?
A survey is simply a way of counting people to quantify the prevalence of a certain opinion or behavior within the population. By interviewing representative samples that constitute a miniature and faithful version of the studied population, by interviewing this kind of representative samples, we can measure opinions, those of the entire population, as well as its subcategories, as we call them. That is to say, men, women, young, old, etc.
There are a lot of misconceptions on how a survey is conducted, particularly regarding the accuracy of the data and the methodology. What are the main data collection mechanisms, and how do you justify the accuracy of the results of any survey?
In fact, opinion polls are as simple as can be. I like to say that to know what people think, the simplest and most faithful way is still to ask them these questions. So in surveys, we ask people for their opinion. The question is, which people? The sample interviewed must be representative. For this, as I indicated, we constitute a miniature of the studied population, and thanks to the figures from INSEE, the Census Bureau in France, we know that the population is composed of X percent of men, of women, of young, of old. So in our sample, we will therefore try to have the same structure based on heavy sociological variables such as gender, age, social professional category, place of residence, etc. This so-called quota method works quite well, in fact, with a simple proof. When we constitute this type of sample, of representative sample, and ask it who it is going to vote for the day before an election, for example, or if it has been vaccinated against COVID, we find to few points near, that's to say the famous margin of error, we find the very same results as those obtained with other more reliable measurement methods, the counting of ballot papers or the counting of vaccination, for example. So, opinion polls are quite reliable in themselves, but beware, the results of a survey are only valid for the moment it was carried on, for a simple reason. People can change their minds.
One of the most important types of surveys conducted in the world of politics is voting intentions. How do these work and how are they used? How can you ensure the accuracy of the voting intentions when the survey is conducted 3 months, 6 months, a year before the actual election?
As I told you, the results of a survey are only valid for the moment it was carried on. Asking people who they are going to vote for when we are far from an election has no predictive value, because people can change their minds during the campaign. And that's quite normal. Otherwise, there would be no need to campaign or to hold elections, and we would decide on our representatives just with surveys. So in short, a survey has no predictive value. On the other hand, it is still useful, because if a survey is carried out before an election, it gives an idea of the political balance of power. We count how many people are for one camp or the other. This allows the camps in question to gauge themselves to know if they need to strengthen their campaign apparatus to make up for their weakness, or, on the contrary, if the game is well underway. Just put yourself in the place of a political force without any survey. A political force which would be convinced that everyone thinks like this force, when this is not the case in reality. So in this situation, this political force would have campaigned as if it had already won, instead of doubling its efforts to convince people. And that would be sad, this realization of such a mistake in gauging the general population's opinion.
European Parliament elections will take place between the 6th and 9th of June 2024 across member states. Can you provide us with the current dynamics within France for these elections? What are the current polls suggesting?
Oh, that is pretty clear. A large victory for the far right. Actually, the National Rally, the Rassemblement National list alone, gathers almost a third of the voting intentions, and that's without even counting on other lists that raise the far-right bloc to about 40% of the vote. The list supported by President Macron, on the other hand, is twice as weak as the favorite list, the far-right list. I think that's a real humiliation for a president who sets himself as a shield against the far-right. The fragility of this list is such that it is gradually being caught up by the social democratic list, in fact.
The rise of right and far-right parties has been gradual yet strong in all of continental Europe and within member states of the EU. A lot has changed since the last EP elections of 2019. In your opinion, what are the dynamics at play in France for this particular election?
The election of Emmanuel Macron in 2017 blasted the French political landscape, and this president has cleverly marginalized the oppositions, with only one exception, the far right. Therefore, since outside of Macron there is no successor, no rival, no opposition figures who have been able to emerge, with the notable exception of Jean-Luc Mélenchon, but who remains quite divisive on the left, in this situation, this leaves only one default choice for anyone who disapproves of Macron's policy, and there are many in France. And that default choice is the far-right vote.
What are the current dynamics of these EP elections, and what differs from the ones in 2019? What should we expect from these elections?
In the political polls, the social democratic left seems to be back in the game. The list supported by the president seems to be very weakened, and the far right is stronger than ever. These are the differences in regard to the previous European election in France. One element to watch particularly is turnout. We feel tremors in the polls, and the context seems conducive to seeing the French reinvest in this long-shunned election. A stronger than expected participation turnout would not change the outcome of the vote in terms of the winner. The winner would still be the far right, but it could reshuffle the cards, especially on the left. In the last European election in 2019, the last-minute surge of young people in the vote had boosted the ecologists at the expense of the right, for example.
Thank you so much for being our guest here at the Ballot Brief. So, now that the technicalities have been laid out, let's have a deeper look at the dynamics of this upcoming European election. Let's start with a look back at the last European elections, where a green wave swept across Europe, fueled by youth engagement under the risen influence of activists like Greta Thunberg. This surge prompted mainstream parties to prioritize environmental issues, sparking debates and actions at both national and EU levels. This environmental surge was reflected in the composition of the European Parliament, where 72 seats were taken by the Greens and European Free Alliance. But amidst this environmental awakening, another trend emerged: the growing influence of populism and the far right. Since the last elections, SND lawmakers focused on issues like climate change and social inequality, whilst their centre-right counterparts emphasized security and the conflict in Ukraine. Looking ahead to the upcoming European elections, projections suggest significant gains for right-wing groups in countries such as France, Spain, Italy, and so on. The Identity and Democracy Group, alongside the ECR, both very right-wing groups, could form a worrying bloc in the European Parliament, challenging the traditional political landscape. However, this rise of the right is not without its controversies. Allegations of foreign interference, such as Qatar Gate and Russia Gate, have rocked the political establishment, casting a shadow over the integrity of European democracy. Meanwhile, issues like the COVID-19 pandemic and Russia's invasion of Ukraine continue to shape the political agenda, highlighting the interconnectedness of national and European concerns. The energy crisis and inflation have also deeply affected the daily lives of European citizens, which have prompted the European Central Bank to collaborate on new instruments to address these issues. Notably, these include the Next Generation EU and the unlocking of funds to tackle some of the aforementioned crises. Amidst these challenges, the European Union faces scrutiny over its policies, such as the ambitious Green Deal. Whilst hailed for its environmental goals, concerns arise over its impact on sectors like agriculture and business, further exacerbated by the war in Ukraine. Several concerns loom at the forefront of both national and European concerns: immigration and agriculture. A big topic of debate amongst MEPs and European member states was the Migration Pact. Introduced by Ursula von der Leyen, President of the European Commission, this pact, adopted on April 10th, marks a significant step forward in addressing the challenges posed by migration within the EU. At its core, the Migration Pact responds to the pressing need to overhaul European migration policy in the face of increasing asylum applications and a persistent migration crisis. Supported notably by France, it aims to tighten control over migrant arrivals and establish a system of solidarity amongst member states for refugee distribution. Initially, this responsibility fell solely on first arrival countries like Italy, Greece, or Malta, and leading to inefficiencies and criticisms. The pact seeks to address these shortcomings by introducing more streamlined procedures. So what exactly does the Migration Pact entail? Essentially, it comprises three main pillars: accelerated border management, enhanced cooperation with countries of origin and transit, and a revamped solidarity mechanism designed to be more flexible and responsive to evolving needs. However, the road to adopting this pact was far from smooth. Negotiations were fraught with political tension, reflecting the deep divides within Europe over migration issues. Yet, after a series of arduous negotiations and compromises, MEPs finally gave their stamp of approval to the pact. Despite its adoption, the Migration Pact serves as a stark reminder of the ongoing challenges facing Europe in managing migration. With the issue remaining a contentious battleground, it underscores the need for continued dialogue and cooperation amongst member states. As we navigate these complexities, one thing is clear: the European Migration Pact represents a starting point in the ongoing quest for a more cohesive and effective approach to migration within the EU. Second, we turn our attention to the farmers' protests, which have been making headlines across the continent in the past several months. These protests, organized by cross-country organizations with a joint strategy, have become an arsenal for the far right, drawing attention to the grievances of farmers who feel marginalized by EU policies. At the heart of these protests is opposition to the EU's new environmental policies, particularly the Green Deal. Farmers argue that regulations limiting the use of chemicals and greenhouse gas emissions are hampering their business and driving up costs, especially when compared to low-cost imports from third countries, such as those under the Mercosur agreement. Andrei Gajdos from the Slovak Chamber of Agriculture and Food assert that the protests are not against the EU itself, but rather the wrong decisions taken by the European Commission, encapsulating the sentiment of many farmers, which are frustrated with their perceived impact of EU policies on their livelihoods. Whilst the Green Deal initially garnered support for its ambitious targets for biodiversity and emissions reductions, farmers and businesses now argue that these targets come at too high a cost, exacerbating already a challenging market. Let's begin with the storm swirling around Germany's far-right Alternative für Deutschland party. As the party launched its EU election campaign, it did so amidst a maelstrom of controversy. The absence of lead candidate Maximilian Krah, embroiled in an espionage-related arrest of one of his assistants suspected of spying for China, underscored the party's rocky start. Despite facing declining poll ratings, the AfD chose not to dwell on their European program. Instead, they seized the opportunity to castigate Chancellor Olaf Scholz's government. Accusations flew, with the AfD lambasting the government for allegedly steering Germany towards war and deindustrialization. Moreover, they stood firm against immigration. Contrastingly, the Social Democratic Party launched its campaign with a rallying cry for hope in Hamburg. Led by Chancellor Scholz himself, the SPD sought to allay fears amongst German voters regarding the country's involvement in Ukraine's conflict. Scholz reassured the electorate of Germany's unwavering support for Ukraine whilst advocating for a cautious approach to avoid direct confrontation with Russia. With the European elections looming, Germany finds itself at a political crossroads. Current projections paint a picture of a closely contested race, with the European People's Party leading the charge alongside the CDU, followed by the Identity and Democracy Group in alliance with the AfD. Meanwhile, SND and Greens vie for their share of the spotlight amidst shifting political tides. As the countdown to the elections continues in Germany, the collisions of controversy and hope promises to shape the country's political destiny. Now, let's investigate the strategic moves of Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni and their potential implications for the European elections. According to recent polls, Meloni's party is poised to secure up to 24 seats in the June elections, with a projected 27% of the vote. In a bold announcement, Meloni revealed her intention to run as her ruling party, Fratelli d'Italia's lead candidate, aiming to unite center-right forces and push the left into the opposition, even within the EU. Whilst Meloni's bid for a seat in the EP would require her resignation as prime minister, this scenario is deemed highly unlikely. Her move follows a precedent set by previous Italian leaders like Silvio Berlusconi and Matteo Renzi, who also maintained their position after participating in EU elections. Despite criticisms of European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen's tenure voiced by Nicola Procaccini, co-leader of Fratelli d'Italia, Meloni's decision is seen as a strategic move to bolster her standing amongst the Italian electorate, rather than a genuine pursuit of a European parliamentary seat. Meloni's political alignment within the European Parliament is also noteworthy. Whilst her party leans towards the European Conservatives and Reformists, ECR, the centre-right Forza d'Italia is affiliated with the European People's Party. On the opposition side, the Partito Democratico aligns with the socialists at SND, whilst Azione, Italia Viva, and Plus Europa are part of the Renew Europe group. MEPs from the Movimento 5 Stelle are non-attached, while the left group lacks Italian representation. As the European elections draw closer, Meloni's maneuvering adds a new dimension to the political landscape, both in Italy and across the EU. Our focus shifts to France, where the upcoming EU elections are being cast as a prelude to the 2027 presidential showdown. In the eyes of some parties, like the far-right Rassemblement National, led by Jordan Bardella, these elections serve as a referendum on President Macron's Europe. Bardella urges voters to use the opportunity to sanction Macron's Europe, framing the EU polls as a crucial step towards the next presidential race. It's important to highlight the unique significance of these elections in France. As the only major elections before the 2027 presidential race, there's a strong temptation to nationalize the ballot, shifting the focus from EU-wide issues to domestic concerns. The trend of, quote, nationalization, end quote, in EU elections is not new. For decades, studies have shown that the scale of the election inevitably influences voter behavior. For example, despite polling at only 2% in the last presidential elections of 2022, the Socialist Party currently enjoys a 14% voting attention in France, illustrating the impact of the electoral context. There is a growing awareness amongst certain demographics in France that Europe is more than just a distant entity in Brussels or Strasbourg. However, for others, national concerns often take precedence over European issues, highlighting the complex dynamics at play. When it comes to the most pressing issues for the EU, migration crisis and climate change top the list, far ahead of common defense or aid to Ukraine. President Emmanuel Macron's ambition to bolster Europe's military power faces challenges, especially considering the fact that the EU is not a political union. Moreover, there's a clash between the ideals of European sovereignty and national sovereignty, with voters demanding a re-articulation between the European project and national interests. For instance, recent polls have suggested that a significant proportion of French people prefer migration policies to be handled at the national level rather than by common EU policies. As the June 9th election approaches, young voters remain disengaged, with only 31% planning to cast their ballots, contrasting with their general support for European principles. This civic disengagement underscores the challenge of mobilizing the youth demographic in EU elections. Hence, France will be a key member state to look at the outcome of these elections in June. We finally turn our attention to Poland, where the ruling Law and Justice Party, the PIS, is taking a firm stance against the European Green Deal, sparking debates and protests across the country. PIS leader Jarosław Kaczyński has made it clear the European Green Deal is a non-starter for Poland. He argues that the deal would spell disaster for Polish agriculture, leading to higher energy and transportation costs, and ultimately threatening the country's economic stability. In a bold move, Kaczyński has nominated former Vice President of the European Parliament, Jacek Emil Sariusz-Wolski, as a candidate for the post of Polish EU Commissioner. Sariusz-Wolski echoes PIS sentiments, calling for a reclaiming of Europe as a community of states and nations. On the opposing front, Prime Minister Donald Tusk and his party, Civic Coalition, are gearing up to challenge PIS's dominance in the upcoming EP elections. With a promise to reverse democratic backsliding and strengthen ties with Poland's Western allies, Tusk aims to mobilize voters amidst the ongoing crisis in Ukraine. Kaczyński warns of other perceived threats to Poland, including the migration pact, the changes to the treaties, and the imposition of the euro. He believes that Poland's sovereignty is at stake, with the EU seeking to centralize power and control Polish assets. Meanwhile, the influx of cheap grain into the EU adds another layer of complexity to the debate. Farmers protest against the European Green Deal, fearing its impact on their livelihoods, whilst Ukraine struggles to rebuild its agriculture sector in the wake of Russia's invasion. Poland finds itself at a crossroads. Will PIS maintain its platform of division and resistance to EU policies? Or will populist parties like Konfederacja seize the opportunity to push for a bolder Poland on the European stage? Poland is a key member state to watch out for in these elections. The considerable number of seats, which is 53, as well as its geopolitical and economic status, will provide some crucial aspects of what is to come for the EU. Overall, a lot is at stake for the European member states in the upcoming elections of June 2024. Undoubtedly, the composition of the parliament will have considerable impact on the next wave of EU policies. Before moving on to the recap of last month's elections, I would like to thank Konrad, who has helped me write this segment on Poland. Konrad is a deputy editor and one of our most dedicated writers here at EuroOpinion, with some truly fascinating and brilliant pieces on Polish politics, which I highly recommend reading. Now let's look at the recap of last month's elections. The April 10th legislative election in South Korea marked a historic moment in the nation's political landscape. With a record-breaking turnout of 67% of eligible voters, the electorate delivered a resounding blow to President Yoon Suk-yeol and his ruling conservative People's Power Party. It was, in essence, a referendum on the president himself. The liberal opposition bloc, spearheaded by the Democratic Party, clinched a landslide victory, securing 175 seats in the parliament. Additionally, the sudden emergence of former Justice Minister Cho Kuk's Rebuilding Korea Party further bolstered the Liberal bloc's strength with an additional 12 seats. The sweeping victory grants the opposition a supermajority, enabling them to fast-track legislation and bypass filibusters. For the first time in South Korea's democratic history, President Yoon's party will not hold a parliamentary majority throughout his single five-year term. The election outcome reflects the electorate's dissatisfaction with the dire economic situation, characterized by soaring prices and record tax shortfalls. President Yoon's austerity measures and tax cuts for corporations faced strong opposition, paving the way for the Liberal bloc's triumph. In sum, the election results signify a significant shift in South Korean politics with profound implications for the country's governance and economic policies. The Solomon Islands' recent elections has ushered in a new era of political uncertainty and coalition building. Never before has an entire cabinet contested under a single party, the Ownership Unity and Responsibility Party, led by Manasseh Sogever. However, Sogever himself opted not to stand as a candidate, throwing his support behind former foreign minister Jeremiah Manele. With no clear winner emerging from the election, the two major opposition parties formed a coalition challenging Sogever's Our Party for governmental control. The economic downturn and criticism of Sogever's government's reliance on Chinese aid have fueled discontent despite transformative infrastructure projects. Although Sogever's Our Party remains the largest with 15 seats, former opposition leader Matthew Well's Democratic Party and Peter Candelaria's United Party have significant support. Independents and smaller parties also hold sway in this parliament. Whilst Sogever has faced setbacks, his history of political maneuvering suggests that the path to power may not be closed for him. The Solomon Islands now stands at a crossroads, awaiting for the formation of a new government amidst shifting alliances and political rivalries. Kuwait recently held its third vote since 2022, marking the fifth general election in 5 years. Despite the hope for change, few alterations were seen as opposition candidates secured 29 of the 50-member assembly, mirroring last year's outcome. Notably, only one female candidate was elected, echoing the previous parliament's composition. The new emir, Al-Sabah, aims to drive economic reforms to modernize Kuwait's economy and align it with its Gulf neighbors. However, disputes between the National Assembly and the royal-appointed cabinet have led to constant deadlocks, delaying much-needed reforms. The parliament's primary task will be to approve the emir's choice of crown prince, with implications for Kuwait's future leadership. In an unprecedented move, if the assembly rejects their heir, the emir will present three candidates for parliamentarians to choose from. With the composition of the new parliament closely resembling the previous one, Kuwait faces ongoing political challenges as it navigates through economic reforms and leadership transitions. In India, the elections are still taking place and are to be held in 7 phases from April 19th to June 1st and aim to elect 543 members of India's lower chamber of parliament. Recent opinion polls predict Prime Minister Modi's BJP and its allies will secure a victory for a third consecutive term, with Modi's policies emphasizing India's economic growth, strengthened international relations, and welfare initiatives for millions of citizens. So far, phases 1 and 2 have registered 67% turnouts, and engagement is predicted to be strong in the upcoming phases. We at The Ballot Brief will continue to monitor developments and bring you the latest insights. But in the meantime, there are several articles in our Year Opinion website written by our brilliant writers which dissect some of the aforementioned elections, so feel free to have a quick read. I am Adeli, and thank you for joining us. Stay informed, stay engaged, and until next time, take care.